Hello and welcome. This is Dr. Andrew Jones, and welcome to the Veterinary Secrets Podcast. This is episode 3. In today's podcast, we're going to be covering dog and cat vaccines, what you need, what you don't need, the risks of vaccinating, the risks of not vaccinating. I'm going to comment on the recent tweet from the British Association of Veterinary Association, which they said that vaccination has provided the single greatest contribution to the health of our pets over the recent decades, as well as talking a little bit about the recent vaccine controversy, especially in light of the measles outbreak that's going on. Then lastly, I'm going to cover a listener question of the week, which was my 9-year-old dog has been diagnosed as a diabetic and now has developed cataracts. Is there anything holistic or alternative that I can do? And yes, you can. First, thanks for you who are listening on today's podcast. For those of you who are new subscribers, a couple different ways that you can subscribe to the podcast. First, you can go to iTunes, just search for Veterinary Secrets Podcast, and then subscribe. You can also get the Veterinary Secrets Podcast on your phone. What you need to do is bring up the browser on your phone, type in vetsecrets.podbean.com/mobile/, and then you can download that, and you can actually have a little icon right on your phone, which I've got on my phone now, which is somewhat impressive, at least I seem to think. And then thanks, and for any of you who have any questions at all, feel free to comment on the blog where I'm posting the podcast. You can also directly send me an email, which is just podcast@veterinarysecrets.com. That's podcast@veterinarysecrets.com. I'm looking at all of our listeners' questions, and once a week we're answering a specific question. So if you've got a particular dog or cat health question, or just a comment in general, you know, animal related issue, feel free to comment on the blog post on the my blog itself, the Internet Pet Vet, where I'm posting all the podcasts, or send me in an email, and that's podcast@veterinarysecrets.com. Thanks again for being a listener, and it's great. It's sort of just a new journey in terms of me being able to communicate with now listeners as opposed to readers and viewers. So let's get right into today's podcast, sort of the risks of vaccines. Should you be vaccinating your dog or cat, period? And, you know, what should you really believe, and what are the sort of real truths or concerns? Obviously, I come at it a little bit different. My last dog, Hoochie, he developed cancer at the age of 8. Do I know exactly why? No, I don't know. But I suspect that part of that came with him having multiple yearly vaccines. You know, that's what I was advising my clients to do. I mean, so I felt it was only right if I did the same thing. A young age. I mean, he was a sort of German Shepherd, lab, mixed breed, essentially healthy dog. He should have strong genetics. He had every reason not to develop cancer. You know, so it really had me questioning what I was advising clients and maybe some of the stuff, the information I've been taught. And I really feel that part of that was, you know, he had this constant bombardment on his immune system from these recurrent yearly vaccines. They wore him down and in some part played a role in him getting cancer. If I had to do it all over again, would I give him yearly vaccines? No, I wouldn't. Obviously, there's issues in veterinary medicine. Fortunately, it's somewhat changed. I mean, but at the time, we had these vaccine reps. I mean, they're great at informing veterinarians about the newest upcoming disease. And the whole point was, what you need to do is you can better help your clients by vaccinating. Not only by doing vaccines is that helping your clients, you're also making your practice more profitable. But clearly, I mean, there's a whole bunch of new research that has come out. And, you know, I wanted to quote an immunologist, Dr. Ronald Schultz, who had this to say, that annual revaccination provides no benefit and may increase the risk for adverse reactions. The percentage of vaccinated animals, in terms of those vaccinated as puppies, protected from clinical disease after challenge with canine distemper virus, canine parvovirus, and canine adenovirus in the one study was greater than 95%. No question, in the past, the conventional approach was to get annual booster shots. Unfortunately, now there really is this big growing body of evidence against vaccinating yearly. And unfortunately, the majority now of veterinary colleges, I mean, they all advise against yearly vaccines. And most of the current protocols, even coming from the Veterinary Medical Association, such as the CVMA, the AVMA, are all saying, pointing against these yearly vaccines. Unfortunately, though, not all veterinarians are on board, and there's some clients are getting mixed messages, pet owners around, should I be giving this vaccine or not? Obviously, we don't want our pets to get sick, and I can very much relate being, you know, a dog and a cat owner, being in the same boat. You want to do what's best for your animal. The last thing you want them to do is to get a serious, preventable, infectious disease. But I think you need to be informed. So let's go further into the topic. First, what are some of the negative effects of vaccines? They're numerous, varied. They can range for different things. First, there's the immediate and short-term reaction to vaccines, including acute allergic reactions such as itching, vomiting, diarrhea, facial swelling, weakness, difficulty breathing, shock, and even death. There's the local reactions, you know, such as swelling, abscess, pain. Then there's generalized systemic reactions, fever, loss of appetite, weakness. Then there are also a host of immune-related and long-term diseases, which can include an immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, immune-mediated skin disease, thyroid disease, vaccine-induced skin cancer, especially in cats, skin allergies, arthritis, leukemia, inflammatory bowel disease, and neurologic conditions, just to name a few. Really, there are links to the most common chronic health diseases of our dogs and cats due to over-vaccination, which makes you really think. Yes, there's some good points in that the incidence of vaccine side effects appears minimal for most dogs and cats that are given a reduced number of vaccines as infrequently as possible, you know, such as the new reduced vaccine regimen I'm going to discuss. If more veterinarians would comply with these new guidelines, we would have far less dogs and cats with vaccine side effects. For you to be able to put this in context, let's just look at the real incidence of disease, and let's just use rabies as an example. I mean, the incidence of rabies in North America is extremely low, with virtually all of the cases occurring in the eastern United States. I did some research looking at Canada, for instance, in 2011, which reported that one dog positive in Quebec, two cats positive in Saskatchewan and Manitoba, three animals total. In the area where I live in, the province, British Columbia, its last positive case was a cat reported in 2007. In 2010, I looked at some of the U.S. stats. They reported 303 cases of rabies in cats, 69 cases in dogs, two human cases. But then let's put this in context. We've got the North American dog and cat population is estimated at 130 million. So you've got the real incidence of rabies is approximately 0.0003%, which means that it's beyond extremely rare. Clearly, rabies is easily preventable with vaccines, but the concerns are with the timing of the vaccine, its side effects, how often it needs to be given. Most veterinarians are advising that the rabies vaccine is to be given at 12 weeks, followed up with a booster at 1 year, then repeated every sort of 1 to 3 years thereafter, depending on the associated province and state regulations. But rabies vaccine itself is associated with a number of serious diseases, including the autoimmune diseases, hemolytic anemia, polyarthritis, thyroid disease, you know, some of the things we just talked about earlier. So really, the risk of vaccines, regardless of whether it's a rabies or the non-rabies vaccines, they need to be weighed against the risk of getting the disease. And based on these real health risks, my suggestion, for instance, with the rabies vaccine are that you wait until your dog or cat is 6 months of age before giving the first rabies vaccine. Clearly, this is different if you've got an animal that's outside exposed to other animals that may have rabies. But for the most, in most part, that's not true. I really advise you not to give it in combination with other vaccines and avoid giving it if your pet is sick in any way. There's a group advocating for pet owners called the Rabies Challenge Fund, and their goal is to extend the legally required interval for rabies boosters from 5 to than 7 years. Because what they're seeing, and they're actually firstly conducting and financing 5 and 7 year rabies challenge studies at the University of Wisconsin. And based on sort of some of the human research, where we, for instance, can have a rabies vaccine and it may last well over 10 years, maybe 15 years. So what do you as a pet owner do? I mean, really, what do you do? Clearly, vaccines have helped prevent some serious illness, but they need to be used with caution and respect. So before vaccinating your dog or cat, consider the risk. If you've got a cat that's strictly indoors, will never be exposed to ever unvaccinated animals, clearly the risk is extremely low. Obviously, the decision about vaccines is very individual, should be guided by your own research on the subject before you go to your veterinarian. So let's look at sort of the vaccine guidelines. There's a couple of different ones. The World Smile Veterinary Association has published basic vaccine guidelines. Also, I really like the University of California, Davis, UC Davis. They've got some great vaccine guidelines as an appendix. So I'm going to publish that following this podcast in my blog post. So what are my advised vaccine regimen? And if I were to have a puppy or kitten, it's exactly what I do. So here's my suggestions. One, I think the puppies and kittens only need a series of 2 vaccine boosters, one at 8 weeks, then repeated at 12 weeks. Clearly, that is the most critical time to prevent infectious disease at this young age. Really small kittens and puppies, I actually almost prefer to wait until 12 weeks before starting that vaccine regimen. The traditional third booster in puppies is not necessary. If possible, delay giving the rabies vaccine until at least 6 months of age. Puppies should only only be vaccinated for parvovirus and distemper virus. Only give Bordetella, that's the kennel cough vaccine, if you're going to a kennel or a puppy class, the rabies vaccine at 6 months. Kittens should be vaccinated for the respiratory viruses, panleukopenia, feline bilateral tracheitis, Calaisi, Panleuke, also known in combination as FVRCP. Feline leukemia viruses should only be given in the rarer instances to these high-risk cats, to those in multi-cat households or outdoor cats surrounded by a large cat population. Once again, if you're going to be giving your cat rabies vaccine, it's at 6 months of age. Ensure that the vaccines are given in the sub-Q tissue on the lateral sides of the right and the left legs. But clearly, if you've got a strictly indoor cat never going to be outside, do they need vaccines? No, they didn't. If I would have a strictly indoor kitten never to be outside, I wouldn't be giving it any vaccines at all. Common sense requires that you should be just keeping your dog or your cat safe, especially if you've got these young puppies, avoiding areas where they're potentially likely to get disease or that high traffic area at the dog walk. Lots of fecal matter, potentially there could be a dog there that's had parvovirus, has had so that virus particles in the soil, avoiding that till at least your puppy is fully vaccinated. I don't recommend vaccines for coronavirus, leptospirosis, Lyme disease, Giardia. I don't advise vaccines for the cats for FIP, that feline infectious peritonitis, feline Bordetella, FIV, and really limited use of feline leukemia vaccine. I advise being especially cautious with rabies vaccine and, you know, really be aware of the risks or not the risk in your area. If you happen to be in an area where rabies is an issue, you know, such as that the eastern seaboard of the U.S., and you've got an outdoor cat, he's exposed to other animals with rabies, obviously, fair enough, have your cat vaccinated for rabies. Or you've got a dog, likewise, in this a similar situation, then have your dog vaccinated for rabies. But also look at how frequent that rabies vaccine needs to be given. Maybe it just needs to be given the one time, you know, at 6 months of age, then have your dog or your cat follow up and titer test it. They don't need to be repeated to be vaccinated again and again. My sort of current advice then is to have your dog or cat titer tested at a year of age after these series of puppy and kitten boosters, seeing if they have protective immunity. They may then need no additional vaccines after that period of time. Routinely always then booster these dogs and cats at a year, but it may mean they don't need it. So if I was to have a puppy and kitten, I would go through the series of puppy and kitten vaccines. In the area where I live, rabies is an issue. I wouldn't give rabies as a vaccine. And then I would titer test them at a year later. If their titers were adequate, I wouldn't vaccinate them. Then get another titer test 3 years later. If they're adequate, I wouldn't vaccinate them. You should still see your veterinarian for the annual wellness exam. It's a great idea, period. Never vaccinate a sick or weakened animal. If your puppy or kitten is showing signs of allergies or skin problems, just wait. You know, clearly, if you're going to vaccinate already immunocompromised animal, you can make them sicker. So that's sort of my take on it. Obviously, do your own research. And as I said, it's also based on the diseases in your area in conjunction with your veterinarian, but just make an informed choice. And that's the sort of biggest point, more important than anything else, that you're informed, you're aware of diseases in your area, the risks of getting that disease. So let's get on to the second topic here. And it's all about the vaccine debate again. And I'm sort of going on to the vaccine top. So clearly vaccines and disease are in the news again. There's been a whole variety of debate on television, on radio, etc. In particular, focusing on measles, which there's been somewhat of an outbreak in some parts of the United States, some parts of Canada, where we've got, you know, scientists on and a variety of prominent physicians talking about, once again, reiterating why you need to have your child vaccines, for instance, such as MMR. Other those who are very opposed to vaccines coming out, talking about their concerns about the issues around potential side effects of vaccines. The British Small Animal Veterinary Congress fairly recently tweeted a statement saying that vaccines has provided the single greatest contribution to the health of our pets over recent decades. Clearly, there's a sort of bitter general movement within the media and within the medical and veterinary community to raise the profile of vaccines, to question those who are gaining a whole lot of media and media traction in support of not vaccinating. So there needs to be some, what I think is some common sense. And obviously, there's some points to be taken on both sides, the pro-vaccine side, the anti-vaccine side. But what do I think and sort of where do I stand and where's a good common sense? Taking these entrenched statements on either way, for instance, British Veterinary Association statement, I think it's somewhat misleading. And if anything, it further entrenches those who are in the no-vaccine camp. You know, clearly, vaccines have helped thousands of animals. Rabies, for instance, is fully preventable with vaccines. In fact, you know, I even suggest that you have rabies in your area, have your dog or cat vaccinated for rabies. But the whole issue then is, how often do they need it? Maybe they only need it every 7 years or 10 years. They don't necessarily need that yearly rabies vaccine. And I mentioned earlier, I talked about the Rabies Challenge Fund. I wanted to read some additional information from their site, because this is a combination of researchers as well as concerned dog owners who are really trying to elevate the knowledge on the subject and really look at, yes, they're understanding the importance of vaccines, clearly having preventing rabies with vaccines, looking at, and their concern is that we're giving it too much too often. Quote from their site was, research has demonstrated that over-vaccination can cause harmful effects in dogs. Immunologically, the rabies vaccine in particular is the most potent of the veterinary vaccines and associated with significant adverse reactions such as polyneuropathy resulting in muscular atrophy, inhibition or interruption of neuronal control of tissue and organ function, incoordination and weakness, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, autoimmune diseases affecting the thyroid, joint, blood, eyes, skin, kidney, liver, bowel, and central nervous system, anaphylactic shock, aggression, seizures, epilepsy, and fibrosarcomas at injection sites are all linked to the rabies vaccine. It is medically unsound for this vaccine to be given more often than is necessary to maintain immunity. Yet scientific research strongly indicates that the 3-year booster interval required by state laws may be unnecessary. And that directly comes from the Rabies Challenge Fund. If you wanted to go online, you can read it. It's at the Rabies Challenge Fund, rabieschallengefund.org. So what should you do? Well, clearly it's a very personal decision based on your research, communication with your veterinarian, the likelihood that your dog or cat will get a particular infectious disease in your area. And as I said earlier, personally, I'm no longer vaccinating my own dogs or cats, period. They're middle age. They had vaccines as puppy and kittens, and no question now. I mean, they're no longer at risk of infectious disease. The risks of vaccinating outweigh the rewards. I really do advise a very limited vaccine protocol, giving a small number of core vaccines only to puppies and kittens. What are my sort of suggestions to those pro-veterinary associations and to those in the human pro-vaccine camp? How about starting with some basic acknowledgement? It goes a long way with your spouse. It's going to also help your cause. If you present both sides, you just might engage the questioning vaccine camp and have those who are shying away from your veterinarian's office or your medical office, your doctor's office, willing to listen. Cataracts and diabetes. And I wanted to now get on to our listener's question who wrote in and said, you know, they have a dog that has diabetes and has since developed cataracts. What can I do? I wanted to give you a little bit of background as terms of what is a cataract. A cataract is this darkness or an opacity in the lens of the eye. The entire lens may be involved or just a part of it. The big point is that eventually your dog will not be able to see through this opacity. So why do diabetic dogs get cataracts? So the lens of the eye is normally hard, clear, and it almost looks like glass. But what can happen is the lens itself, it's supported by these fibers and it's encased in a capsule. But it depends on fluids for nutrients. The lens itself doesn't have a direct blood supply. So normally the lens, it absorbs sugar or glucose from the eye fluids. But sometimes if you have excess sugar in the eye fluids, what happens, it'll pull water into the lens, which in turn affects the clarity of it and causes a thing called the cataract. There's just too much sugar, drawing too much fluid in there, affecting the clarity. Hence, that's clearly why you're seeing it with diabetes. I mean, you've got an animal in terms of diabetic where they're no longer able to regulate their blood sugar. They're not producing adequate insulin. And that high blood sugar is then secondary affecting the eye, causing fluid to be drawn in, hence the cataract. So what do you do? What's the first step? Clearly, first, you're seeing your veterinarian. You're discussing diabetes. It needs to be well regulated regardless. There, surgery is an option. There are some non-surgical options, which I wanted to discuss. But it needs to be reasonably well regulated, especially prior to surgery. In practice, I was always under the opinion that if we saw a cataract, a not well regulated diabetic, but it just takes some subtle changes. It can happen fairly quickly. And there are some dogs that have been pretty well regulated as far as diabetes go, still developing cataract. Interesting side note is that now we're seeing in people, for instance, that have much more measurements around their regular fluctuations in blood sugar, that there's huge swings even throughout the day. And they can even happen with very similar foods, with similar lives, sort of similar things happening throughout the day based on similar exercise levels, etc. Because other things that are dependent are going to affect how the insulin is metabolized, how the insulin works in terms of lowering the blood sugar, other hormones going on in your pet's body that can then affect how their blood sugar ultimately is. So my point is there are a whole number of variables. So you can expect these big wide swings throughout the day. So then what happens though is, and for the majority of times, and are even well-controlled diabetics is still going to be slightly above what normal would be. We're not going to be keeping it sort of somewhere between 4 and 7 for 24 hours throughout the day. And there's going to be times where it spikes, especially after eating, where it spikes up above 12 and 15. And that's causing consistent elevated sugar, which then can secondary affect the eye and cause that cataract. So my point is, you can see how easy it is to have. You can have a well-controlled diabetic and still end up with cataracts. So then your options are, but we need to know it's as well-controlled as possible. So it may mean that we're altering insulin. We may mean tweaking out the diet in terms of more protein in the diet, more canned food. We may alter the brand of insulin. We may be giving it more frequently. Maybe we've only been giving it once a day. Maybe we're going to be then giving it twice a day, which most animals are on twice daily insulin. So that's our first big thing. We're controlling it. Then we client visit an ophthalmologist. And they would talk about a couple of different surgical options. One's called a lens extraction. And the other one is called pheomulsification. We're actually using a laser to break up that opacity to help it clear up the lens itself. This is an expensive option. In some cases, it isn't an option. Maybe you've got an older dog. Your concern is, can they withstand surgery? And the second obvious concern is just with the cost itself. So are there other options? In the past, I recall many a client having the same question, is there anything else I can do? And we would talk about the occasional supplement, and I don't ever recall one really being that beneficial. And we would say, we've got to control the diabetes as best we can. The hard thing is once the cataracts have developed into these mature cataracts, they've been difficult to reverse. Fairly recently, a group of ophthalmologists, so these are veteran ophthalmologists or eye specialists, developed a supplement called OcuGlow RX. So it's a specific canine vision supplement. It's a nutraceutical comprised of 12 different natural antioxidants, including grapeseed extract, lutein, omega-3 fatty acids, along with lycopene, the antioxidant in green tea, EGCG, coenzyme Q10, alpha-lipoic acid. The ones I've talked about for different things, if you're on the webinar, you would have heard some of the same antioxidants being discussed. So that it's all formulated in a capsule formulation, and it's all based on sizes. There's one size, these gel caps, one size for small dogs weighing 10 pounds or less, one for medium and large dogs weighing 11 pounds or more. Claim it's going to reverse advanced cataracts. No, they don't. But have there been a number of satisfied clients have actually seen some marked improvement? Yes, there has been. So that's, I think, the big point. So it's called OcuGlow RX. In Canada, it's only, you need to Google, it's only available for in a pet supply store in Toronto, but it can be shipped to your house. In the United States, it's available in a number of different places, OcuGlow RX, and also through all the veterinarians. So any veterinary clinic could order this product in, and you could then have it. So most of the veterinary distributors are going to be able to get in OcuGlow RX. So if I were to have an older dog, such as my older dog, Jesse, and if he were to develop, especially cataracts, especially secondary to diabetes, no question I would have him on that supplement, because I wouldn't be looking at surgery. So thank you. We're coming to the end of podcast number 3 of Veterinary Secret. Thanks for listening and being on the podcast. And once again, I encourage you, one, to subscribe. Subscribe on iTunes. Just go to iTunes.com and search up Veterinary Secrets Podcast. You can subscribe. Get Veterinary Secrets Podcast on your phone. Type in into your phone, vetsecrets.podbean.com/mobile/, and then downloading the little app, and you can click on it and listen to the Veterinary Secrets Podcast. I'm going to be posting a new one each week, so I encourage you to send in your suggestions, responding on the blog, or send me directly an email at podcast@veterinarysecrets.com. Once again, thanks for listening. I look forward to talking to you again next week. This is Dr. Andrew Jones.